Coming up on First Course Verse, Herbie Hancock. Red Hot Chili Peppers. Social Distortion. Violent Femmes. Mew. Soul Asylum. Aerosmith. Marilyn Manson. Korn. And of course, Soundgarden. These are a few of the artists that the producer I'm talking to today has worked with. That's next. Verse Course University, L here. How is it going? I am well, very well. This is going to be a fun one. Super excited. First interview of the year. Starting it off with a bang, a very, very big bang. We have never had a producer on the pod. We have had people that have produced music. I shouldn't say that. We've had musicians that produce their own stuff. We've had some indie artists that produce their own stuff. And then, of course, real large artists that have had a hand in production, but nobody that is specifically production. And moreover, nobody that is specifically produced massive, massive rock albums. But before we get into that, how's it going? Everybody well? Enjoying the pod so far this year? I hope so. I guess I can get into this right now. What am I drinking? You know what I'm drinking. I drink it all the time. It's an Irish coffee. It's Jameson. It's not the best one I've made at all. I overdid the cream, so it's a little too creamy. That's okay. My daughter very much appreciated the fact that it was heavier for her strawberries this morning. But other than that, it's still a wonderful drink. I need the coffee and I need the shot of confidence because we are about to talk to a producer extraordinaire. We're about to talk to Michael Beinhorn. He has worked with some of the biggest artists you know, people of my generation, the generation before me. Yeah, it's a generation after too. Why not? On some of the biggest albums, a couple of which we are going to talk about on the podcast. Our last episode was on Super Unknown by Soundgarden, one of the most prolific rock albums to come out ever. Of a specific time in the 90s, it was kind of the perfect rock album, which we talked about with our friend Johnny Vinyl, who was nice enough to join us. Johnny, thank you. This will be a good cap off to that. And then in our next episode, we're going to talk about another album that he did that I think is one of the most well-produced albums of all time, that I've heard at least. There's a lot that I haven't heard before, I'm sure. Michael Beinhorn has been producing since the early 80s. I think he might have even, he did some stuff starting in late 1979, going into the 80s, picked up steam, and then producing Future Shock with Herbie Hancock, which that's the one that really put him over the mark. Everybody knows, everybody loves Herbie Hancock, and everybody knows one of the songs from there. From there, it's Red Hot Chili Peppers, it's Violent Femmes, and then, of course, Super Unknown. He's worked on some massively high budget albums. You know, The Untouchables by Korn, I think, had like a $3-something million budget, most of which I heard tell they blew through before production even started. That's pre-production without being pre-production. We're going to talk to him about that. He is a big vocal believer in pre-production for very obvious reasons that have been lost today in the industry. People don't pre-produce anymore, and it's not all their fault, although it is, we'll say it's 50-50. I mean, who can afford to do pre-production anymore, right? And honestly, this year, with us talking 1994, yes, I went after interviews that would have to do, that would pertain with 1994. This guy produced Super Unknown. Okay, there you go. Our next interview had, she had one of the other biggest albums of 1994 come out that I love to death. But I'm going to tell you, I didn't have Michael Beinhorn on for Super Unknown. I really didn't. Michael has, his own thing going now, a new view, and he's been doing it for a while. He's been writing on what's happening with the industry for years and years and years. He has his own website, michaelbeinhorn.com. So Michael, and then Beinhorn is B-E-I-N-H-O. I'll put it on here. H-O-R-N. He has his own website that essentially offers things like pre-production, offers notes. You can send him your music and he'll tell you what he thinks needs done to it. He will analyze individual songs. He has courses. There's all these things that he's trying to help because he sees the writing on the wall. He knows, he's been sick of it looking from the inside out, that there are new methods needed for the music industry. Everything's remote, so you're not going to get that in-studio feel anymore. And there's just a lot of consulting and a lot of thinking about things before you record that people don't really believe in anymore as much. Pre-production, if you listen to him, if you read some of his writings, pre-production is the biggest thing he harps on, which it's not a complex thing. It's making sure that your music is good enough and ready before you get into the studio. It's a big deal. And it sounds like a simple thing, right? But I assure you, it's not. I'm not going to waste a bunch of your time. I want to get into it. We're going to talk about all this stuff and I'm sure more with him. Hope you're enjoying these. Hope you love the interview. I am very excited. Michael Beinhorn, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on the other side. Here with Michael Beinhorn, who hopefully is feeling okay because the entire West Coast is sick. a little unfortunate.
Yeah, well, if you got like a six-year-old, it's even worse.
I have a nine-year-old and I have a two-month-old. So.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
I've got two Petri dishes on each side just concocting everything they can.
Best of all possible worlds.
Yes.
In many ways.
It is. I'm okay with it. I want to start kind of early on and then talk a lot about what you're doing now. But the first question I want to ask you to lead into some other ones is how old were you when you co-wrote and worked on Rocket with Herbie Hancock?
I was 22 years old when we did that, and while the project was being made, I turned 23.
That's pretty young to be working with an artist like that.
I mean, I suppose so, in the context of what was happening at the time, and I guess the confluence, the intersection of events, it didn't seem so unlikely at the time.
An artist like Herbie Hancock, because, you know, Future Shock and that the early 80s stuff that he got, I don't want to say repopular for, but really helped him in the early 80s. A lot of hip hop influence, a lot of, did you bring a lot of that as a younger person, or was that more him, or was that more you?
To contextualize it, we created the tracks at our studio in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I actually had never met Herbie in my life or spoken with him until we got off the plane with our tapes of the rhythm tracks and pretty much everything except the keyboard overdubs that he wound up doing. So as far as the influence, as far as where the tracks came from, that was completely us.
Coming up to now, which is, like you said, it's 40 years difference. The industry has completely changed. A lot of your writings, you've written a fantastic book called Unlocking Creativity. You had a blog up until a few years ago that was called How to Save Popular Music. And a lot of that stuff you've continued on now on your website, working really on with extremely well-priced production. What I would say is probably based around the fact that most people nowadays have no money in the music industry. It's very difficult. We have a lot of independent artists that listen to this that are, you know, trying to produce out of their basement. And One of the big things you talk a lot about that I love and that I want to hear you speak on is pre-production and how important it is. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
What is the importance there and how much has pre-production changed over the last 10 to 15 years?
Very broad and
yeah.
wide-ranging questions in there. Well, you know, first off, like I feel at this point that the whole concept of like the popular song per se as an idea, as a thing, is pretty much a notion of the past, especially mainly as it pertains to like big deal, big time pop music.
Okay.
I have not heard anyone within the past, like maybe 10 years or something like that, and it's been pretty consistent by now, write anything that has any kind of emotional weight to it that I feel is going to really sort of exemplify this era in terms of how pop music in the past has been kind of has exemplified or I guess underscored other eras or points in time. And you know, I mean, it's a function of many things, mainly the business, I would say, as defined by the major labels. That's not to say, however, that people can't do this on this the very same thing on a much lower level,
you know,
on an indie or even a sub-indie level. And that's really what I've kind of put all of my focus onto now. The work that I did in the past was really directed, I feel, towards the 0.01% of musicians who are at the upper echelon of music creation. And now I'm more interested in the 99.99% of other musicians in the world that are trying to do something, but don't have to conform. They don't have to find themselves in the inevitable box that the major label system puts you into. And I mean, because the whole process of music production has changed so drastically now.
Mm-hmm.
And going to what you asked at the end of your question regarding pre-production, this is one of the many things, along with artist development, by the way, which these are some of the many things that have been tossed by the wayside in the process of streamlining the process of turning music production into content creation.
Yeah, gotcha.
And pre-production is, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if people even know what it is at this point, but it, you know.
That is very unfortunate.
It is, and I think that people need to be made aware of it again, because it's, in my opinion, not only one of the most important phases of music creation,
mm-hmm.
but possibly the most important. It's the process before recording, when people sit down and analyze what they've got, and really kind of take it apart, kick the tires, poke holes in it, listen objectively to what's going on, see if it's working, see what's not working, which is far more important than listening to a piece of music and going like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, it's like, yeah. Okay, what about this really sucks? What about this isn't working? And it's a skill that people who compose music don't always have, nor are they supposed to have it, because if you're expressing something that comes from you emotionally, you're completely subjectively wedded or related to that. Like, it's not your business to be objective about it. You know, I mean, if you can be, more power to you, but I have met very few people who are capable of doing that and making something that's truly substantial, and often only for moments. You know, it's one of the most important things that you can do, because it's basically QCing your music. Giving, you know, doing quality control.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think back to musicians of yore and artists of yore. Like, I like to collect bootlegs of, you know, bands like the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, just because there's such a rich historical, you know, tranche of data that kind of shows you what their creative processes were. And these weren't guys who like flew by the seat of their pants the way a lot of people like to romanticize. Like, these guys worked their fucking asses off. Like, they just sat in studios for hours and days and weeks on end, boring everyone else to tears, you know, just laboring painstakingly over what everyone else would have considered small details. I mean, I read something recently where Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees got invited to a Beatles session, and he sat in the studio watching them sit around, and at one point they played one song over and over for 8 hours, and I think it was Getting Better off Sergeant Pepper.
Okay.
They kept playing it over and over because Paul McCartney said it just didn't feel right. It wasn't right, you know, just kept banging away at it, you know. And then listening to different iterations of Led Zeppelin songs like Black Dog or No Quarter, you know, I mean, when you start listening to this stuff and you hear how things metamorphose and develop and evolve over time to, you know, from the point where they of inception to the point where they actually were deemed recordable, it's a lot of process and a lot of evolution, and people aren't allowed the luxury of being able to do this now. It's like, go in, you know, have a bunch of songs, cut them, get out, the end. You know, what are you doing to make the songs better? What are you doing to really invest them fully and say all the things that you have to say and use them as the expressive platform and tool that they really always have been? I mean, honestly, this is one reason why I do feel that popular song, at least from the standpoint of big time pop music, doesn't have the same kind of weight, because no one's willing to make records like this anymore.
I very, very much agree. We talk about that quite a bit on our podcast. And to put it into a little bit of historical context with you, you've worked with a couple artists. When you worked with Soundgarden, for example, this was at a point where they were kind of almost guaranteed to succeed. Like, the album Super Unknown was just, it wasn't, even before it was Super Unknown, everybody was like, well, Soundgarden's next album is going to be amazing. So, but that must be difficult to come in as a producer. Was that a lot of pressure to come in with something that's just supposedly guaranteed success?
Well, supposedly, you know, and you're absolutely right, by the way, that was the perception throughout the music industry. And, you know, with certain artists, you knew who they were and that their next record was going to be explosive. However, there's always one mitigating circumstance here, and that is if the band actually make that record that's going to explode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can look at the trajectory of an artist based on what they've done and be like, okay, they're, you know, if they keep evolving at this rate, their next record's going to be ridiculous, right?
Yes.
But if you don't actually deliver, and this is where we've seen a lot of careers go like that.
It just know, mimicking their the successful sound until it gets old. Is that kind of,
or coming out with a record that doesn't meet that kind of arc?
Yeah. Okay.
That doesn't satisfy the kind of trajectory that they've been on, because the expectation is if they went from point A to point B, point C, and made such a significant jump, point C is going to blow us out of the water. You know.
Yes.
So, the job was to make a record that would literally blow people out of the water, you know. But the problem was, is that when I got their initial demo tapes, they did not blow me out of the water at all. In fact, I had to contact the management and be like, we can't go in with these songs.
Oh, wow.
You know, this is not enough. Yeah, I mean, they sent me like 10, they sent me a demo tape with 10 pieces on it. Five of the songs were finished, and the other five were just sort of like rough ideas and jams and stuff like that. And, you know, some of the song, all five of the finished songs wound up on the record. But it wasn't It wasn't what they needed. You know, I heard it and I was like, this isn't going to cut it.
So what is it
You
about
know?
your personality that was good with those artists, and now that, what is it about you that makes it to where you can go into a room with a Jonathan Davis or a Chris Cornell and say, like, hey, you've got work to do? That seems like it would be incredibly hard to do.
I guess it just depends on what you're, on how you're contextualizing everything. You know, for me, I mean, I guess by nature, I'm somewhat introverted, but if I have a standard, like an aegis under which I'm kind of operating, a mission statement, you know,
There,
like this is, these are your, these are your orders. Like, that's what I'm going to do, and there's nothing that's going to stop me, you know, because there's a responsibility in that, especially when it's someone else's music. You know, with a band like this, they're tasked to do a certain thing. I feel that in my bones. Like, all right, this is my job. I got to help these guys get it to the finish line, but it's got to get to the finish line in a way that's going to deliver. At that point, going into a room with someone like Chris or Jonathan, it's kind of like, yeah, well, you know, we just got to do what we got to do.
One of the topics that you cover in some of your workshops, and you cover in your writings as well, is you talk a lot about solving creative problems. And I'm wondering if that method changes a lot based on how big the budget is, or how famous the person is, or if you're working with somebody that's, recording out of their basement.
Given the scope of what each artist is doing, obviously the financial aspect of it, the resources play a tremendous role in the process. You know, an artist working in their basement is, in many cases, can have many of the same basic issues as a person who's working in an enormous studio with like a fantastic budget. They may have experience things slightly differently. They may not have been treated with kid gloves by their record label, you know, or live the kind of life that they're able to live because their artistry has paid for everything that they do and that everything that their families do. But creatively, a lot of people are facing the same dilemma. Like,
Absolutely.
and a lot of times it comes down to one thing. It comes down to why. Why am I doing this?
Yes.
It's not even what am I doing? It's why am I doing this? But it's not, but that's not just, it's not just a kind of like, you know, why do I get out of my bed every day and do this? It's what am I really trying to say? What's inside of me that needs to come out? And I think over time, these kinds of things have fallen by the wayside again because of what music and art creation have been turned into in terms of what they represent content-wise, rather than their intrinsic meaning and their intrinsic value. And I think being able to share that insight with an artist and help them go inside and touch upon those things and really do a deep dive is incredibly important and incredibly valuable.
Is that a lot easier to do with artists that haven't, an artist that comes to you seeking help on production nowadays that doesn't have a huge budget versus like when you worked with Korn on Untouchables, which is an incredible album. That had such a big budget. They were already stars. They didn't, I'm sure there was a portion of them what was like, I don't even need to do this kind of thing, which I'm not, that's projecting, but still, do you find that a lot easier to get that message across to people that are using a lot of their own money to finance these projects?
I don't want to say yes, but yes. I'd like everything to be in parity and equal, but yeah. And I think the reason for this is that once you've achieved a certain level of success, you're kind of like, and even if you know that there's further that you can go, there's a part of you that doesn't want to hear about it. There's a part of you that doesn't want to think, ah, you've got further to go, but you know it took a lot of work to get where you are right now, which means that you're going to have to do an awful lot more work to get even further than where you are right now. And you sure as hell don't want to do it because life is so much nicer now that you've got your mansion and your nice cars and all that money in the bank and you can eat wherever you want and stuff like that. If you want to go further, if you're still in touch with that artistic driven creative part of you that had all that gumption to take you from point A to point B, this is what you got to do. And it's never fun. It's never pleasant. It's always a big, big pain in the ass. And people don't, most people at that level will go into it kicking and screaming, really.
Okay.
Because it's a bitch. It really is. It's a bitch, you know? Whereas someone who hasn't had that experience and really wants it is going to be more receptive by nature.
And do you still, you probably don't have to deal with this as much, but I'd imagine, I mean, you work with musicians, so there's going to be a lot of ego, there's going to be a lot of depression, there's probably not as much nowadays, but substance abuse. Did you, is there a lot of therapy? Is there, are you a kind of a therapist at times in your job?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all part of the same thing. Again, like art creation comes when it's done from the purest place in a person. It comes from very deep inside, and it's touching on every other aspect of a person's psyche. It can't not. It's all interrelated. It's all part of the same thing. It's all underlying the same organism. Yeah, of course.
Before we talk a little more on your current projects, I just want to touch on one more that, because I do think that And the Glass-Handed Kites by Muse is it's one of the most well-produced projects I've ever heard. I've been in love
Oh,
with that since
thanks.
the first time I've heard it. It's unbelievable, but it's so incredibly unique. And I'm just And I'm just wondering how, when you first started working with Mew and just the unique sound, was this more of a working to find their sound or just kind of a get out of the way and let them do their thing?
I mean, I like all the records I've worked on that I'm especially proud of. This was definitely a collaborative effort. There was a lot of brilliance that came from those guys. Sonically, I had my own ideas about how it was going to be presented. The mix was done was a little bit different, wound up being a little different than what I had been expecting. The record that we made was a little bit raw, more raw around the edges, to be perfectly honest. But I'm not disappointed with it. It was the whole thing was it was a collaborative effort for sure. They're such great composers and their approach was so unique and unusual
Yeah,
and
I would think so.
Yeah, I mean it was a tough record to make because there was a lot of bickering that went on. But yeah, it worked out.
I want to talk a little more about your writings because you've written some really, really smart stuff that I think that a lot of independent people doing their own thing could really use. You talk a few times about somatic awareness. Is there, can you explain what that is and why it's so important for producing?
I can explain why it's important for every aspect of life.
I love that.
It's, well, I mean, it goes to the heart of emotions and how we interact with the world. What is a feeling? A feeling is a sensory experience. It is literally a feeling. It's something that you feel in your body. You get a sensation. Normally, when you feel sad or feel this way or that, it's you only think it's sad because of the attachment that you've created, the link that you've created between an event and the somatic, the sensory experience in your body that resulted from that experience.
Interesting.
But yeah, that's the feeling. That's the connection. Sad could be any number of things to any number of people. No one is going to experience it exactly the same way as you. I mean, you may talk about, well, I feel it here in my body and here, and someone's going to say, oh, yeah, I feel it exactly the same way, but it's never going to be exactly the same way because experience, brain chemistry, body chemistry, you know, the whole nine yards, it's everything is so different, yet we've developed methods of communication to be able to share these things amongst ourselves and compare notes, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
But music has a somatic, and as do all the arts, but I would say music in particular has a somatic component to it. When we listen to music and we get feelings from it, what's happening? You're experiencing it in your body, right? You feel it. Like,
absolutely.
I mean, when I was little, I remember my folks used to play Feed the Birds from Mary Poppins, and I'd burst into tears on the spot.
Love that
right
song. Yeah.
Yeah, right? I
Absolutely.
Mean, it's gorgeous. And
it really
I start
is.
Crying, and no one could figure out what was wrong with me, you know, but it's like, it was a really emotional, like a profoundly emotional experience for me. It's just like, and it was like knee-jerk, just like that. That's the impact, the somatic impact of a piece of art. And
yeah.
As artists, what we do is we are putting our own somatic experiences into a piece of music. I mean, it's not something that we do consciously, but it's there and it has an effect. If you're using your art, your medium, as a means to express yourself, you've got one side of the equation figured out. And this is why when guys like Rick Rubin talk about, like, you know, making art for yourself, it's kind of like, oh, dude, no. you don't get it, you know. That's not what this is about at all. It's a whole different thing. Music is not about jerking yourself off. It's about communicating. Art is about communicating. You think that you're expressing yourself, that's one part of the equation. What's your ability to communicate that, you know?
Yes.
It's really what this process is, you know, there's two distinct ways to define art in this context, right? One is what I say what I'm doing is art. The other is, do you agree? You know, if you look at a piece of art, because like I can sit around all day long and insist that what I'm making is art, right?
Yes.
But if no one else agrees with me, it's like this, you know, did anyone hear the tree fall in the forest if no one was around? You know, was there like a sound? You
so
know,
this is a very Zen process of thinking about these things.
Well, but it's logical too. You know, it's like how did I communicate this idea? If art is a form of communication, music is especially powerful for communicating ideas. Did I communicate this? Did I get this across? And let's make a distinction here, because that's not about pandering to people. Because when you do this, you don't think about it. Like, you don't go, did I communicate this effectively? How the fuck are you going to know? You know what I mean? Like, you can't
Yes.
know. This is like one of the beautiful things about it. You can't know. But if someone comes up to you randomly and goes like, I don't know what you're doing, but it's like changed my life or whatever, then you know. But this is like the whole thing, and this is where the somatic aspect is crucial. Like, you're communicating feelings, thoughts, ideas, moods. They're all coming across in this music, and that's why and how, when you listen to music, if it's really got that in it, and not all music even has to be. Some of it's highly intellectual, So it's communicating ideas, and you resonate with it that way. You know, and it's funny because there's a physical component to this. There's a French word called frisson. Have you ever heard this?
I have not.
Okay, yeah. The sensation, the physical sensation of listening to music, or I guess that you can get from any art form, like when you get goosebumps or the
Yes.
hairs stand up on your
Yeah.
body, that's frisson. That's a rea like a physical reaction. So this is like, you know, there's plenty of op-ed whatever evidence to, you know, to explain this whole process.
You know, by our very, very short time talking, you seem to have a very passionate and very a very true way of looking at things. When you got done with Super Unknown, I'd imagine you must have been offered a lot of stuff. What have you found over time? Because looking at your resume of production, it's incredibly strong. And I just get the feeling from talking to you that you aren't the type to just take on any project. How did you go about picking it throughout your career up until now, what you wanted to and didn't want to be a part of?
I kind of started from a place of things feeling a certain way for me. I can't really explain it. But no, I guess I just did actually with that whole thing about somatic. I did, you know, but I mean, that's really what it was. I mean, the whole principle has sort of dictated the way I've worked over time. Like, you know, I kind of rolled with a certain flow. And it's interesting because at one point I kind of really wanting to produce the same way I was working because I found that the business end of things was no longer supportive of making records the way I'd become accustomed to doing it. So it's a very, I guess it's very vibey in a way. You
That
know,
makes sense.
yeah, I've liked working with big artists and having lots of money to roll with. The process of making records has changed so much, and it's not the same thing. And there was something, I guess, equal parts fun and frustrating and just crazy making about being in a studio, laboring over these things just to kind of like get them to all go like this perfectly. I love that. I still love it. And in the absence of being able to do things like that, I'm sort of like, you know, like I think I'd rather do something else, something that's purposeful in a completely different way.
Do you ever miss that, or do you find that there are a lot more pros now to being able to really work with anybody, anytime, anywhere?
I do miss it from time to time. You know, I mean, I went to Los Angeles last summer and worked with an artist named Kuko on a recording, which was a lot of fun. Musically, it was much different than anything I'd done, but it was, you know, it was nice to be in a recording studio again, having that kind of rapport with people face to face. I also realized that it's something that I don't want to devote my entire time to, and it's not something that I'm going to be able to because, again, people just don't work like this anymore. It's not, it's a whole different process. The expectation is you have to be in and out very fast. You don't have the kind of resources to really kind of sit around and labor over stuff anymore. And pardon me, I like working like that. I really do. I think it's better for everyone else and me to be here in a little bedroom in my house surrounded by these beautiful acoustic curtains, listening to people's music and just analyzing it, you know, and listening to what's going on and being able to hear how to get a better guitar sound or how to help someone with their performance and things like that, you know, or just reviewing songs and corresponding with people via email.
Now, the way that you do things now through your website and the different things that you offer, it does seem like you have a large plethora of projects ongoing all the time. So as a nowadays producer who's doing these kind of smaller things to help the smaller people out, what is a typical, is there a typical work day for you?
It's pretty variable. You know, I can do a couple of sessions in a day of people all over the world, you know, getting like a guitar sound or a bass sound or a drum sound or a vocal performance, and then sitting down and doing a couple of like quick listens of people's music and sending them notes. And it's amazing how like sending just a couple of paragraphs of notes just busts people's heads open and makes them think, because all of a sudden, hey, I've got a whole new perspective on my music that they wouldn't have gotten anywhere else. There used to be a service actually called Music 180, and they sort of offered something like this, where you could get like some fantastically famous producer to comment on your song for like, you know, $50, $100 or something like that. And most of it was like guys saying, yeah, I love it, it's great, blah, 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 which of course was tremendous help. You know, that's going to give you everything that you want. Whereas if you just sit down and listen to a person's music, you can, you know, if your ear is trained, and yes, my ear, I'm good, I'll say it, my ear is trained. After 40 years, I'd better hope so. And, you know, and offer some insights into issues that aren't superficial but are systemic to the music.
Okay.
Just get like a couple of comments, you can blow people's minds with this. Because all of a sudden they've got a perspective they would have never taken on something that suddenly appears to be so obvious and logical, and they get to take that away from with them and look at their music for the first time from a whole different point of view. You know,
yeah.
That, and the response that I've seen to that is just, it's absolutely wonderful. You know, so I'll do things like that and coach people. They're good.
What is the biggest thing that you tell people that a lot of people who submit to you are looking for something that you end up having to tell them first and foremost?
Well, a lot of people reach out to me on social media, and most of them are like, I want you to produce my record. And ultimately, that's going to cost them too much money that they don't have. I would rather, for their sake as well, offer them something that's going to be a lot more cost effective. Because why do you want to fly me out to where you are, have me fly, or have you fly to my imaginary studio that I don't have anyway? You know, like, the cost of all this stuff is going to be insane. Then you got to pay me, and it's like, you really don't want to get into that, you know? But if you want to hire me for a half hour or an hour, it's going to be a lot. It's going to cost you comparatively speaking, almost nothing to do that. And you can do it online and X, Y, and Z. So this is like a whole new approach, but people don't understand it. They can't, it's hard for them to get through their heads the idea that, wait, I can get this guy to sit with me in his studio, and he's actually listening on equipment that's better than what I have in my room right now, so he can actually hear what I'm doing better than I can, even though he might be halfway across the world. So explaining the process, explaining these things, explaining stuff like pre-production to people, it's like bringing a horse to water. You know, making him drink is a whole other thing. But explaining to them the principle that what the gulf between what they want and what they can get is actually a very big one. But what they can get is in many ways comparable and perhaps even better than what they think they want.
Do you think that some of that stems from the fact that there's just a lot of these people, they want that romantic, they have that romantic vision of their head of, you know, I'm going to play a bunch of music, and then some label's going to hear it and love it. And then I'm going to get this big time producer to come in, and I get to hang out in the studio with them. And
yeah, I think that they have bought into it and they want it. And it's the grand illusion, basically.
Yes.
They think, and also they think that that's actually going to get them what they want. But like, the truth is that most of the people who are actually going to take money from an artist like that to come and work on their record, they're going to be pricing it out accordingly. Like, what's my time worth?
Mm-hmm.
So if an artist has like 40 grand to make a record, which of course is an insane amount of money these days, the producer's going to go, how much time does that work out to me? Okay, I got my studio, I got my assistant. Like, what can I get done in a week, in a week for 40 grand? What can I get done in 2 weeks for 40 grand? Okay, so maybe that works out to 2.5 weeks. Like, I mean, think
Yeah.
about that. 40 grand for like 2.5 weeks of work.
Yep.
Just so someone can like pay that, make their house payment and pay for their Mercedes and stuff like that. And cover the
Yes.
payments on their SSL and pay their assistant and pay their rent for the studio.
Yeah.
But that's really where the thought process goes. In my model, that doesn't exist. I'm online. You're only paying for my time at this point. You're not paying for my studio. I've got no overhead. There's nothing that needs to be done, and it's quick and fast. And I'm not like sending you a contract to like sign away your firstborn or
Yeah.
anything like that. It's a whole different thing. There's a much greater level of convenience. And yeah, so yeah, people do, they crave the romance of that old model. But the reality is that unless you're on a major label, it's simply not feasible anymore. I mean, there
It's
are some
not.
people who will come to you, but unless you've got like a whole enough money to make it worth their while, they're not going to play with you.
Well, and not only that, but nowadays, unless you already have a pretty prominent social media following and they see that they aren't gonna have to do so much work with promotion because you, as an artist, have to do your own promotion nowadays. What I'm trying to get at is that I think the way that you are doing it is the way that things need to be headed, and that I'm hoping that a lot of the listeners, a lot of the independent artists out there, will move to something like that and use things like this, like what you're doing, to their advantage because it's cheap and it's going to help a lot.
Yeah, well, that's the idea for sure. I mean, it's funny though, because a lot of producers I know are very resistant to the remote model as well. Many people have invested lots of money in a recording studio in their house or,
Oh, yeah.
on their property and stuff. So it's very hard to tell them, hey, you know what? You're probably better off not having all this stuff. You're probably better off just letting the artist work with it and have you just direct the session from someplace else.
Makes sense.
And there's also another component in the model, the pre-production part of it, because most producers now don't know how to do it. They don't know how to analyze a song, work with the arrangements, work with the structure, the dynamics. Tough. It's heavy lifting that a lot of people want to avoid. Because it really there's a lot of brain work involved in it. You're not sitting around,
Yeah.
you don't get like the immediate feedback of hearing something come out of the speakers at you. You actually have to sit there and think about what you're listening to and really break it down.
It's a very hard, it's the hard part, I'd imagine, for the producer and the artist, because you're, as the artist, I think a big part of pre-production is just being told that this is not good enough yet.
It's hard, but you also have to be able to support that with a why. You have to be able to explain yourself if you're going to say that to someone. I mean, if you're going to critique somebody, you can't just say, "Well, it sucks." What is that? What good is that doing? Why am I paying you to tell me something sucks? I should be paying you to. I should be paying you to tell me how great it is. In fact, I am paying you to tell me how great it is, so you better tell me how great it is right now. No, if I offer a critique to someone, I'm also including with that a reason why I feel the way I feel. And I also make sure to contextualize that with, this is my feeling. This is how I feel about it. This is not gospel. It's not an absolute reality. This is what I'm hearing when I listen to your music.
Gotcha. Do you have a project that you have worked on that you think more people should be aware of? A project that you got done and you were just like, my God, this is so good. I know there are projects like we've talked about Super Unknown. You've worked with Korn, Red Hot Chili Peppers, all these people, Hole, Is there one that maybe people aren't as aware of that you've worked on that you are extremely proud of?
Not really. No, I'm happy with all of those.
They're all very good. You should be.
Well, thanks. Thanks. They were received. Some of them were received very well. A lot of them were actually. I have no complaints.
Last question for you. If you could give one piece of advice to very independent artists on here, we're talking, I think a large bulk of our listeners are, you know, people working through their homemade studios with Ableton and a dream. What's the one piece of advice that you would give them?
Boy, I don't know that there's any one piece of advice that I can really offer. There's so many. I mean, I think it's of paramount importance to really be able to contextualize the work that you're doing by so many different things. I mean, that's really a tough question to answer. In the cases of some music, pre-production, like if it's Ableton based, if it's electronic, pre-production's a whole different thing because you're sort of building the track up as you go.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in a spontaneous process of pre-production and recording at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you know. But being able to contextualize what you're doing by how you're feeling is just really, I feel that that's incredibly important. It's really important to contextualize what you're doing by how you're feeling and just to be in touch with that from moment to moment.
I think that's a great answer. We have reached the end, my friends. What a really cool dude. You know, I've watched a couple things about him producing. There is a documentary of the making of End of the Glass-Handed Kites where he's in a lot of smoking stogies. And you can tell right away that he's not successful because of any hidden, you know, formula. It's because he's very blunt. He's very honest. He has no filter. And he was very good at telling these musicians, hey, this sucks. This does not suck. It's easy to say, but actually not that easy now that we're where we are. But just imagine being in 1993, knowing that you're going to work with Soundgarden, who was about to come out with everybody knew that that album was going to be huge, and going to a Chris Cornell and saying, hey, this sucks. You don't have any good music on here yet. You have one good song. And eventually having to sit down with him and say, look, man, you really got to look inward or else this isn't going to work. That takes brass balls. That takes a very specific type of human. You, in that interview, he's very, he kind of deflects that sort of thing. But hey, you know, it is what it is. Like the guy knows what he's doing. So michaelbeinhorn.com, go check him out. Go check out all the albums that he's produced. You know, like he's done a few good ones, ladies and gentlemen. And yeah, to Michael, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming. And most of all, I appreciate your hand in the art that has been such a massive, massive part of my life. Two of the biggest albums of my life were produced by him. I mean, what more can I say than that? VerseCourseVerse.com, at VerseCourseVersePod. Hey, everyone, you're the bee's knees. We love you to death. We'll see you next week to end our Michael Beinhorn coverage with a DL's 10 out of 10. That's right. We are covering one of his albums that he produced. And like I said, this is a big one for me. This is one of my favorite albums of all time. One of the most well-produced albums of all time, in my humble opinion. And I am dragging along Rachel and Evil for the ride. DL's 10 out of 10 coming next week. Good night. And good luck.